It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. U.S. officials say hackers in China launched a massive cyber attack on the federal agency responsible for collecting background and issuing security clearances for millions of U.S. government employees. Office of Personnel Management said Thursday as many as 4 million current and former federal employees may have been affected. It said that number could go higher as the investigation continues. A Chinese embassy spokesman in Washington said China outlawed cyber warfare, saying jumping to conclusions and making hypothetical accusations, he says, not responsible and is counterproductive. Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko has warned lawmakers to prepare to defend against a possible full-scale invasion by Russia after a surge in fighting in Russian-speaking eastern Ukraine. Ambassador John Herbst of the Atlantic Council spoke with VOA.
Over the past week or two, we've seen a great increase in violations by the Russians and their agents in eastern Ukraine across the ceasefire line. And it's become even greater in the town of Martyenko over the last day or two. The Kremlin has put in, over the past couple of months, substantial increase of advanced weaponry. So they can move. They can thrust more deeply into Ukraine at any moment.
Russia insists it plays no direct role in the Ukraine rebellion and has repeatedly denied supporting rebels with weapons and fighters. Ghana's president, John Mahama, says the death toll from a gas station explosion in the capital. Widespread flooding has increased to 150 people. Ghana will observe 3 days of mourning for the victims. This is VOA News. Rescuers in central China have slowly begun to raise a cruise ship that capsized on the Yangtze River and say there is no chance of finding anyone else alive as the death toll reached at least 97. Video shows that one side of the capsized Eastern Star was rolled above water earlier today after crews worked all night to right the vessel. Only 14 people have been rescued since the ship went down in severe weather late Monday. While over 300 passengers, many of whom are elderly, remain missing. Many are believed to be trapped in the hull. Turkey will hold a general election on Sunday with predictions it will be one of the closest in more than a decade for the ruling AK party. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is increasingly targeting the HDP, the pro-Kurdish opposition party, which it says is trying to enter parliament for the first time as a political party. Dorian Jones has details.
With just a few days of campaigning left before the June 7 election, the pro-Kurdish HDP is facing growing political violence. Police use tear gas and rubber bullets to try and stop protesters trying to break up an HDP party rally in the eastern city of Erzurum. In the same region, a mob attacked an HDP campaign bus and set it on fire. An HDP activist was shot dead in southeastern Turkey Wednesday night near his campaign bus. The wave of political violence follows a speech Wednesday by President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, in which he strongly condemned the pro-Kurdish party. Dorian Jones, Istanbul.
In U.S. politics, former Texas Governor Rick Perry is in the race for the 2016 Republican Party presidential nomination. He officially declared his candidacy on Thursday.
We have the power to make things new again, to project America's strength again, and to get our economy going again.
This will be the second run for the former governor, Perry, who tried once before in 2012. He is the 10th Republican to declare his candidacy for the 2016 race. Four Democrats are seeking their party's nomination. International Monetary Fund is urging the U.S. Central Bank to wait until the first half of 2016 before raising interest rates. The IMF will also downgrade its outlook for the U.S. economic growth to 2.5%, based, it says, on a disappointing first quarter. IMF Chief Christine Lagarde says raising U.S. rates too soon could result in significant market volatility around the world. Many private economists speculate the Fed will start raising rates this September, and in an earlier speech, the chair of the Fed, Janet Yellen, said it should come at the end of the year.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, June 5th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Ghana announces 3 days of mourning as the death toll from floods and fires rises.
As of yesterday, the official death toll was put at 150, but it appears that the indications that we may still be counting. Government has declared a 3-day national mourning in memory of the departed souls.
Ransford Tete is the editor of the Ghana Daily Graphic newspaper. More than 50,000 refugees from northern Mali may face food shortages later this year. African ambassadors say the continent is making progress on women empowerment. The U.S. Congress expresses skepticism over future relations with Zimbabwe, and Burundi's president welcomes the postponement of parliamentary and presidential elections.
We do expect that those from the opposition parties that started to go to rallies will join the race again. And we expect that the riots in some streets of the capital are going to stop.
Willy Nyametwe is senior advisor on media and communication to Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza, and the court ordered a third and final trial for former President Mubarak of Egypt. Those stories plus Mark Owoman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ghanaian authorities have declared 3 days of mourning in honor of the 150 people who died from a gas station explosion and widespread flooding in the capital, Accra. It's expected the death toll could rise further. President John Mahama told journalists the government will allocate about $12 million for relief operations and to repair damaged infrastructure. On the line from Accra is Ransford Tete, editor of the Ghana Daily Graphic newspaper. Good morning, Ransford.
Good morning, good morning to your listeners.
We are very glad to have you on the line. What's the latest now about the explosion in Ghana?
As of yesterday, the official death toll was put at 150, but it appears that the indications are that we may still be counting. Government has declared a 3-day national mourning in memory of the departed souls and has given members of the rescue team after Sunday.
What happened? What caused the explosion?
Well, as of now, what we know is that the explosion happened at the fuel station in the central part of Accra, in a popular area called the Kwame Nkrumah Circle. And there was an explosion, but what we've been told is that it was as a result of flood waters that engulfed the whole area, including the gas station. And there was an explosion, and we know that gas or petrol cannot go underwater, so the petrol was floating on the surface of the water. And so when there was an explosion, what happened was that the fire was spreading as the water was also spreading. And therefore, those who came into contact with the fire were seriously burned, and some died as a result.
Now, you said this is flooding. Well, how come you have so much flooding in the middle of the capital city?
You know, I mean, most cities in the world, you have streams or rivers flowing through, and there is a major stream flowing through the central part of the city called the Odo River, and that river got flooded and spread all over the place. There are other drains leading into that river, and those drains were also choked, and therefore there was flooding in the area nearby, and that is what caused the flooding. And as a result, when there was the explosion, many people who were sought refuge at the gas station got caught up in the inferno.
The president of Ghana has spoken about this incident. He said the government is going to allocate about $12 million to deal with the problem. What can the government do to deal with this problem?
Yes, the president has spoken. He has expressed his disgust at what had happened. He described it as unprecedented and expected that when government decides to take action, you know that many people have put up unauthorized structures along the water courses, and that also impedes the flow of water during heavy rains like what happened last Wednesday. And $12 million particularly is not meant to deal with the challenges, but to those who were affected because a number of people who got injured are on admission in various hospitals in the capital city. Government has plans already to build storm drains in the city to ensure that anytime it rains, the flow of rainwater or floods was not impeded.
Ransford Tete is editor of the Ghana Daily Graphic newspaper. He was speaking with me from the capital, Accra. Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza has welcomed the decision by the country's electoral commission to postpone both presidential and legislative elections following unrest in the country. The presidential vote was previously scheduled to be held July 26 this year. Presidential spokesman Willy Nyamitwe says dialogue among the government, opposition, and civil society groups will resume next week.
The president, you know, this recommendation came from his counterpart from the EAC. You know, we say the East African community is one people, one nation. So those advices coming from his counterparts, they are received warmly. So his reaction is that the government is going to postpone elections, and we hope that all the persons from the opposition who didn't go in the campaign or in the rallies will organize themselves in order to continue the race.
Opposition groups have promised to boycott the elections if President Nkurunziza insists on running for another term or seeking re-election. It will not change even if the elections are postponed. How will this crisis be resolved, if I may put it that way?
If I may recall what the opposition parties have said the day before yesterday, when they have released an announcement, a communique, they say that they agree with all the recommendations from the EAC summit. And they said they are ready to join the talks. So let's wait for the talks to begin next week, and we'll know what is going to be the way forward. But what they have said so far is that they agree with what the EAC summit has said.
How committed is the president to holding talks with the opposition to resolve the crisis in Burundi?
The government of Burundi had always been committed to go to talks. Even last week, we were talking with the opposition and the civil society, but they have decided to stop the talks and go out. But now they have announced that they are coming back to join again the talks. So the government of Pierre Nkurunziza has been talking with the opposition and has never stopped talking to the opposition.
So what should Burundians expect following the postponement of this presidential and legislative? What should they expect, especially in terms of restoring peace, law and order, instead of clashes in the streets and people dying as a result of that?
We do expect that those from the opposition parties that stopped to go to rallies will join the race again. And we expect that the riots in some streets of the capital are going to stop in order for everybody to move around freely.
Willy Nyamitwe is a senior advisor on media and communication to Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza. He was speaking with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Bujumbura. While African women have made considerable gains in the political, economic, and social development of the continent, some say they are still widely marginalized within government. The African Union has declared 2015 the Year of Women's Empowerment and Development to All Africa's Agenda 2063. And many women say it's time to put public declarations into practice. Mariama Diallo has more from Washington.
Women are empowered throughout the fabric of Rwandan society and even make up 64% of the parliament, says Rwandan ambassador to the United States, Mathilde Mukantabana.
Primary and secondary schools are free. It means that once you give them that strong beginning, then you are with the other programs at the higher level of university and professional education, women are as competing as men. So we have women who are now flying the high skies in my country.
But Mukantabana says in other parts of Africa, women remain excluded from social, economic, and political power by a lack of education and the inability to own and inherit property.
For me, women's rights is a human right. That's the bottom line.
Empowering women benefits an entire nation, says Mozambique's ambassador to the U.S., Amelia Matosumbana, who also stresses that it cannot be accomplished without men's help.
Why? Because in our societies in Africa, you know that the society is male-dominated. And if we don't have men working along with us, we can have much more difficulties than what we are having now. It's fortunate that men are becoming much more sensitive to the gender issues.
For that reason, laws alone will not bring enough change, says Kamisa Kamara with the National Endowment for Democracy.
The structural barriers that affect women on the African continent and elsewhere also, mostly tradition, religion, patriarchy, etc., are barriers that can only be addressed through a change in mentality.
That change is key, the ambassadors say, because full development cannot happen if half of Africa's population is not fully recognized as equal partners in society. In Washington, Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, June 5th. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. More than 50,000 refugees from northern Mali may face food shortages later this year in the Mbera refugee camp in Mauritania if more funds are not raised. This, according to the World Food Programme. The WFP director for Mauritania, Jean Suvanto, tells Ricky Shryak that the security situation in northern Mali remains unstable, limiting the potential for refugees to return.
All the way from January until today, there has been some small fluctuation in the monthly refugee figure. I think in April, May, there were also some newcomers from Mali due to security situation in the north. However, at the moment, we are somewhere around 50,000, 52,000 registered refugees as of June 2015.
What resource challenges are facing these refugees at Mbera now and in the coming months?
We just had a meeting with key partners today, and I said that actually the first 6 months of this year, we have been able to cover quite well all the needy people, except the month of March. We had a shortfall for the general food distribution. But we were able to cover the most vulnerable people, i.e. nutrition operations and school canteens, thanks to a loan of some of our donors. As I look at the time period of June, September, we are having full ration, except that on cereals, we have only 50% on the month of June. And also month of September, we will have a shortfall of 50% of our cereal components. But then when we start for October and the last three months of the year, at the moment we have nothing. So that was one of the reasons today that we organized the event jointly with UNHCR and government to provide an update on refugee situation, on numbers and financing, and then the way forward later this year.
Jean Suvanto, Country Director for World Food Programme in Mauritania. He was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Nouakchott. The U.S. Congress has raised concern and skepticism over future relations with Zimbabwe. This was revealed through a line of questioning from members at a hearing in Washington on Thursday. Mdimia Kimwakalele of VOA Zimbabwe Service has more.
In their quest to find out what is really happening in Zimbabwe, members of Congress had a barrage of questions for witnesses Shannon Smith of the State Department, former Zimbabwean white commercial farmer Ben Frith, and Imani Countess of the Solidarity Center. Congressman Christopher Smith, the chair of the subcommittee on Africa that sponsored the hearing titled The Future of U.S.-Zimbabwe Relations, raised concern over continued reports of human rights violations by the government and President Robert Mugabe's ability to lead the country.
If the government's repressive tactics are not troubling enough, political jockeying in Zimbabwe, including the dismissal of Vice President Joyce Mujuru, places the succession to President Mugabe in doubt, which puts U.S. policy in question.
Responding to the questions on sanctions, Shannon Smith of the State Department reiterated the position that sanctions were targeted.
We have sanctions on approximately 106 individuals and 70 entities, and they are intended to be targeted. They are aimed at individuals who have disrupted democracy, engaged in corruption and other acts. The Department of Treasury, the OFAC office evaluates those situations. But more fundamentally, it remains the sort of strongest statement, I think, of American values. Does the Zimbabwe government continue to blame their woes on it? Absolutely.
The members of Congress pressed witnesses on the state of the opposition, which the U.S. had once supported and counted on as the alternative government to that of President Mugabe.
It's a matter of sort of fact and record now that the opposition has been splintering, that the Movement for Democratic Change now has multiple movements for democratic change within it under separate leadership. There is no sort of unifying message at the moment that stretches across these parties.
Congresswoman Karen Bass, a ranking member of the subcommittee, too pressed on the question of the opposition, querying reports that they had become ineffective. Countess of the Solidarity Center responded in the affirmative.
At this point, I don't see a viable alternative today. But there are discussions going on. But at this point in time, what is very, very clear that is that no one in power seems to be working on behalf of the people of Zimbabwe, and certainly not the working people.
The congressional hearing ended without any indications of dramatic change in relations between the two nations in the near future, with the U.S. expected to maintain its position of targeted sanctions on President Mugabe and his inner circle. Reporting from Washington, this is Ndimyake Mwakalielie.
An Egyptian court has ordered a third and final trial for former President Hosni Mubarak on charges stemming from the killing of protesters during the 2011 uprising that forced his resignation. But while other Mubarak-era officials are one by one acquitted of crimes during his rule, ousted President Mohamed Morsi faces the death penalty, angering Islamists and other opposition figures, while militant attacks remain a constant reminder of the simmering anger in Egypt. Viewers Heather Murdock reports from Cairo.
During the 2011 revolution in Egypt, protesters and police battled on the streets and crowds stormed the ruling party headquarters. They set the National Democratic Party building on fire, and the flames could be seen from Tahrir Square protests for days. For more than 4 years now, the charred building has stood empty, a symbol of struggle. A few days ago, the demolition began, but as symbols of the revolution fade, legal battles are in full swing. After being convicted of conspiring to kill more than 200 protesters in 2012 and having the same charges dropped in 2014, Mubarak will face his final trial, beginning in November. Prior to this announcement, former President Mubarak was expected to be freed any day, having already served his 3-year sentence on corruption charges. Human Rights Watch Director of Middle East and North Africa, Sarah Lee Whitson, says Mubarak's acquittal in 2014 is part of a larger problem.
It really follows the pattern that we've seen of acquittals of Mubarak-era officials who had been charged with a variety of crimes, the worst of which, of course, were the mass killings of protesters during the uprising against Mubarak, but also corruption charges.
Meanwhile, the Muslim Brotherhood's Mohamed Morsi, Mubarak's successor and fellow ousted president, is possibly facing the death penalty after he was convicted of conspiring to kill protesters. Thousands of other jailed Muslim Brotherhood supporters face harsh sentences, often after being tried in large groups. Ziad Akhl, a senior researcher at the Cairo-based Al-Ahram Center for Political and Strategic Studies, says the two cases are very different because of the current political climate.
You have to bear in mind that the quality of Mubarak's imprisonment is a very high quality, and he is in the most advanced medical facilities that we have in Egypt, which also kind of raises a question. I mean, someone from the Muslim Brotherhood just died a month ago because they wouldn't transfer him to the hospital, so he died in jail.
The crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood, which has claimed hundreds of lives in recent years, has left the Egyptian judiciary with a clear anti-Islamist agenda, he says. And the government, led by President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, does not distinguish between the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamist groups that have killed hundreds of security forces in the Sinai Peninsula in attacks since Morsi was thrown out of office by the military after mass protests in 2013. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Cairo.
It's 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports news, we begin with athletics. 17-year-old Ethiopian world junior champion Yomif Kejelcha ran a lifetime best of 12 minutes and 58.329 seconds to register the world's quickest 5,000 meters this year at the IAAF Diamond League in Rome, Italy, on Thursday night. Kenyan runner-up Paul Kipngetich Tanui, then Ethiopians Hagos Gebrehiwet and Iman Merga, together with Kenyan Olympic bronze medalist Thomas Kemei Longisiwa, are the only others in the world to complete the 5,000 meters in under 13 minutes this year. Others who ran world-leading times in their respective events were Ethiopian world champion Mohamed Aman, who clocked 1 minute and 43.56 seconds in men's 800 meters, and Kenyan Hyvin Kiyeng, who prevailed in women's 3,000 meters steeplechase in a lifetime best of 9 minutes and 15.08 seconds, while Ethiopian world junior champion Dawit Seyaum was third in women's 1,500 meters in 3 minutes and 59.76 seconds. On the infield, Commonwealth Games champion Julius Yego improved his Kenya record with a fourth round throw of 87.71 meters to place second in men's javelin. Turning to football, a brace scored by forward Xavier Godwin, along with goals scored each by attacking midfielder Kingsley Sokari and striker Success Isaacs, powered Nigeria to a 4-0 triumph over North Korea in a Group E tie at the Men's FIFA Under-20 World Cup in New Plymouth, New Zealand, on Thursday. Today, Friday, Ghana play Panama in Auckland. Tomorrow, Saturday, Senegal play Qatar before Mali engage Uruguay in Hamilton, while on Sunday, Nigeria face Hungary in New Plymouth. In Canada, tournament debutants Ivory Coast face their baptism of fire when they line up against Germany at the start of their campaign at the 2015 FIFA Women's World Cup in Ottawa on Sunday. Germany topped the FIFA Women's ranking, while Ivory Coast are 67th on the FIFA rankings. Finally, in rugby, Cameroon, Ghana, Ivory Coast, Nigeria, and host Togo clash in a one-day seven-a-side 2016 Olympic rugby qualifier in Lome tomorrow, Saturday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. Here's our listener mail for this Friday morning, June 5th.
Good morning, Daybreak Africa. Corruption is one of the worst leadership qualities to be identified with a leader, either local or international. And so Blatter should therefore vacate office now and not later. Albert Alagbo from Akanebe and Federal Polytechnic, Ebonyi State, Nigeria. Thank you.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. That's it for this Friday, June 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Botti in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good weekend.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.